Hey guys, it's Mina. On today's episode, my old pal Dominique Foxworth and I are going to talk about the latest CBA news and Dak Prescott's contract. If you don't already, please take a minute to subscribe, give us a rating, 5 stars, please, and leave a review. Before we get to the show, I also want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast. That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. This week, Sarah talks to Charlotte Wilder about her path to Sports Illustrated, how the rules of engagement for women in sports are different, and the time she was nearly run over by a boat. You can find That's What She Said wherever you get your podcasts. Hello. Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the hosts thinks the franchise tag is something you can get engraved at Petco. That's me. Oh boy, it has been a surprisingly eventful week in NFL news. And, as all of this CBA talk heats up, and it really went from 0 to 60, right? It's something we've been hearing about for a while. Oh, the negotiations are going to start at some point. The current deal is ending. There could be some action soon, but it felt like this latest round of news and negotiations came out of nowhere. And I'm really lucky because I happen to be close personal friends with perhaps the biggest expert on this at ESPN. His name is Dan Graziano, and he wasn't available today. So I called Dominique Foxworth and asked him to come on the show. Hey, Dominique.
What's up? I was confused because I was like, this is so nice. What is she doing? And then there comes the curveball.
Before we get into all of this, and so the little housekeeping, we're going to talk about the CBA. We're going to talk about what it means, both, I think, from a player perspective, a business perspective, and also a football perspective, right? Because this is really, like, if all of this goes through, it's going to change football as we know it. So we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about Dak Prescott, who's been in the news a lot lately, and his contract. And we're going to have a discussion, Dominique, that I've been wanting to have for a while about whether or not you can pay a quarterback a mega deal and still win the Super Bowl, or how much of a disadvantage that puts you at. So we're going to talk about that later. We're going to take some questions. But first, we're going to talk about the CBA stuff. And I want to ask you, do you agree with me that it feels like it went from 0 to 60 real fast?
It absolutely did. I mean, normally there is more of a deadline. So like last time we went through CBA negotiations, I participated in them, and there was a clear deadline that we all knew if there was no agreement by this date, we would not have football. So it was like a hard stop. So we knew when to ramp up all the coverage, or I guess I wasn't covering it then, but all the coverage was kind of timed for the ramp up of discussion, and we knew when the deadline was, essentially when the clock would strike zero. But now we're in a situation where there's like an artificial deadline imposed, and it felt like no one was aware that it was coming. Then all of a sudden it was like, hey, if they don't sign something this week, we're not going to be able to change the sport in the way that we expect it to.
I guess I should say that Dominique Foxworth used to be the president of the Players Association, if you don't already know. That's the kind of thing on ESPN Daily we would do with a back announce. Dominique Foxworth is the former president of the NFL Players Association and was involved in the negotiations. Let's lay out the calendar right now. So you and I are taping this on Monday. I'm going to put out the podcast today. We're doing it early because this is truly a moving target. Although, regardless of what happens, I think what we talk about and the terms and the actual important issues in this deal are going to continue to be the important issues now and in the future. Last week, so I think it was Thursday, the owners voted for the deal. And it wasn't a majority. It wasn't all of them, by the way, whatever that means. We could talk about that. Then the executive council of the union voted not to recommend it to the rest of union membership. They voted 6-5, I believe, on Friday. Right now it's Monday. We're told, it's been reported on Tuesday, both sides are going to meet. And then I think on Wednesday is when we're looking at a vote on this. But Dominique, there's kind of, when we talk about votes, there's whether or not the executive council wants to recommend it, and then there's the actual players voting for it.
There's like 1,000 things that are interesting about this. And it's frustrating because I find CBA and labor issues interesting year round, but everyone else finds it interesting for like 1 week every 10 years, which is fine. It's fine. But I don't know if we can get into all the things. So I think the decision is tough, and you count on executive committee that you were talking about, which is essentially 11 people, the president of the Players Association, which is normally an active player, and then 10 vice presidents. They are at the top of the union as far as like hierarchy is considered. Then after that is the reps. Each team has a player rep and an alternate rep, so it's 64 guys there. So right now, the executive committee, their role, and I remember when I was in that spot, our role was to negotiate the deal along with our lawyers and along with the executive director, Demora Smith, to the best of our abilities, and then bring back the deal with a recommendation. There were several times through the negotiations where we were like, this deal is not good enough to bring that back to our players. Once we found a deal, or we got to the deadline where I was like, all right, this is as good as the deal is going to get until we have to strike or not strike, or excuse me, we were going to be locked out or not locked out, miss some games. Once we got to that point, I was one of the executive committee members at that point, and I wanted to reject the deal. However, we discussed it as an executive committee, and we thought that our role was to give guidance to the reps. And so we discussed it, and we decided that we were going to recommend to push forward a deal. I argued and I fought to reject it, but I lost. We pushed forward with telling the reps to sign the deal, or advising them that we thought they should sign a deal. They signed the deal. We went on to have football. And to put this in context of where we are now, the executive committee, rather than coming together and agreeing what they were going to advise the reps, there was enough of a disagreement that they themselves had a vote. And it's crazy to have a 6-5 vote, because that is useless. Like, that's not helpful at all for the reps.
They're also out in public, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. Like Richard Sherman, J.J. Watt. Well, he's not on the executive
committee. He's not on there, but he's an outspoken player who has
guys
influence.
Are saying stuff. So.
And so like the reps are available and they're involved, but they haven't been involved the entire time. So you expect the executive committee, who's been heavily involved, to give a legitimate kind of unanimous, hopefully, recommendation so that the reps can rely on that. But now the reps did not get that, which is why they went to this next step. We're like, all right, well, we have to make this decision on our own because the EC is not giving us any guidance. So we have to have a meeting with the owners. I think that's how we got to where we are now.
The reps, yeah. So every team has a rep and a backup rep, right? And then a backup rep. And then beyond that, there's the vote, right? Which the vote's going to happen. The players are going to vote no matter what. Even if the reps say, this deal sucks, players are still going to vote, right?
The reps vote.
Not the entire body.
Okay. Not the, it's about 1,500 players. The reps vote, and they represent each team. So they're going to have to vote, and they need a majority, a simple majority, 51% of them to, yeah. Okay. To go and ratify the deal. Yeah, they don't need they don't need 2/3, I believe.
Oh,
they need just 50%.
Okay, well, let me address something before we get into the deal. Let's talk about the issue of what this is going to, like, are we going to have football? Because that's the big difference between this time and last time. You know, we're a year out, right? Which is relevant, I think, to the question of leverage and why the owners would like to do this now. Not only because you don't want to get into the Kirk Cousins territory, sort of, where, right. You know what I mean? With next year, where you're actually staring down the barrel of either a lockout or a strike or some kind of weird stuff. There'll be all kinds of weird money stuff, with contracts and just total, a lot of that's going to be really crazy if nothing happens this year, because then you go into the final year. They're trying to do this a year early, because, and I feel pretty comfortable saying this, they would like to go to the television networks because they, NFL, the current TV deals are expiring soon, and say, hey, here's what we got. We've got 17 seasons. We've got a 10-year deal. We've got certainty. Maybe even get out ahead of, you know, the election, some stuff that's happening in the news. Yeah.
That's a lot more games, because you said 17 seasons when you meant 17 games. But if we get 17 seasons into 10 years, good God, health and safety, look out.
It is interesting that this is a 10-year deal, which in some ways is, you know, it's like, wow, we want the flexibility. Much like a player negotiating their own contract, you'd like to get a new deal as a player. But because it's a 10-year deal, if you lock in 17 games, you're not getting that 18th game until, you know, 2000, whatever, which I think is kind of interesting. But in any case, Dominique, they're doing this a year early for the reasons I just described. The owners are very motivated along those lines. But even if nothing happens, let's say, you know, there's the vote Wednesday, whatever, nothing happens. They're playing out this deal. Football is fine. this season. It's next season that you enter the chaos scenario.
Right, which I think is somewhat of an advantageous position for the players to be in. It's very hard to generate leverage given the situation, the current constructs. It's the power asymmetry is very stark between the league and the owners and the players who are largely going to play for 3 or 4 years and trying to make as much money as they can. It's hard to win any sort of protracted labor stoppage where guys are no longer getting paid. So when you're in a situation where you're not looking at tomorrow, meaning we don't get paid, you could argue that the players are in a stronger position. And the point you made about negotiating the TV deals, it matters because in the past we negotiated shorter deals and also with opt-outs. Now we don't do that anymore because the understanding is you can extract the most value from the TV deals if you can give them some certainty. If you can say there's no opt-outs, there's 10 seasons, all of this is guaranteed. You can build your network around knowing you're going to have these games. You presumably have more negotiating leverage, and that creates a bigger pie, which is better for the teams and the players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the players know this. They know the owners would really like to do this now. It's interesting to me that it was reported it wasn't unanimous amongst ownership, but you know, that could mean 31-1 or something. Who knows? Yeah. So football's going to happen. Now, if the deal does happen, notably, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, we get the expanded playoff immediately, right? That's going to kick in right away. But the 17 games is not going to kick in immediately. I think it's going to be a couple of years, potentially, until that actually starts happening.
Yeah, that's how I understand it also. Yeah. But this seems to be that all the information we're getting is from leaks, which makes it a moving target. And also, I think I'll throw in there that the fundamentals of the proposal could change because I do think that the EC, whether they meant to or not, the way things have played out has shifted at least some leverage in favor of the players because the way it was before was the owners have approved it. Now we're waiting on the players to approve it. We've switched that a little bit where it's now like essentially the players have rejected it and they've come back and the reps can walk into that room and say, we can't accept it as it is currently constructed. If you want us to accept it next week, you need to change this deal. And now the time pressure, as we talked about, since the players could potentially play out next season, then if they really want to get this deal done to negotiate the TV contracts, the time pressure then falls on the owners, I think, to the degree that they feel any pressure. Which I don't know that billionaires feel pressure at all, ever.
That's a good point. The public perception right now is this is a bad deal, I think. But we're going to talk about what's actually in the deal. Sure. I think that would almost always be the case because of sort of the reputation. I mean, you and I have talked a lot about perception of the last deal, perception of football and the union and negotiating power versus other sports, whether that's fair or not. I mean, I've seen a lot of people talk about this deal, Dominique, without acknowledging any of the gains. And there are some notable gains in here that I have not heard mentioned. For example, the rise in minimum salaries is a big deal for most of the players in the NFL. Okay, like this, and I'm not saying this is a great deal and the 17 games thing is huge, and we can talk about whether the compensation for that is fair, but there are many facets to this deal that I think the average player would like a lot. Now, that's not all of the players, but a lot of them would.
I think you're right. So the one thing that I would say, it's difficult for me to like position myself in this way where I can pass judgment on this deal because I remember the last deal being done and being annoyed and angry at people passing judgment who didn't participate in the negotiations. So it's would be awfully rich for me to come do it now, but I'm going to do it. So I do think it's notable that all major sports unions over the last decade plus have taken steps back financially, have given up some portion of their revenue split. This will be the first time that it seems like a major sports union or group of players have gained something in the revenue split. The cost of it, and as I've talked about this to you and to other people, is like negotiations is not about walking in a room and like playing poker. Like people think that if you are a fast talker or you can like outsmart your opponent. No, it's kind of about leverage and paying the price. So in this situation, that jump in revenue split, the cost of it is a 17th game. I don't know if it's worth it, but yeah. It is notable to say that they are going to get up to 1.5% increase in revenue share, annual revenue share of all revenue, which is a misleading term to some degree. But anyway, the point is they will get a gain when every other sports union, hockey, baseball, football, basketball, football included, every other sports union has taken a step back financially in the last decade plus.
Let's talk about the 17th game, because that's really the only the only issue here, right? Because, you know, there are all these, there are the gains I mentioned, you know, like the minimum salaries. Obviously, there's changes to training camp workloads, off-season, various benefits, testing, neutral arbitration, yada, yada, yada. And I think they're expanding who's eligible for pensions as well. The playoff, expanded playoff, that's fine. That's a win for players, honestly, because the amount of money they're going to make off of that and the amount of actual football you're adding to that. The issue is the 17th game, and that's the holdup. So you talked about kind of cost versus benefit there, right? So what you're getting out of it, you mentioned you're going from potentially 1.5% more. It was reported last week when the owners voted on it, that could be $5 billion for the players over the course of the entire deal. Now, right now, you and I talked about this, trying to immediately do like back of the envelope math. Right now, the NFL makes a little over $15 billion a year, I'd say. So going up 1.5% would mean about $225 million more per year, which is obviously times 10 falls short of $5 billion. So what you're counting on is revenue going significantly up. I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's going to be a lot because live football is like the only valuable thing on television. I mean, well, but, you know, who knows if that's true. But in any case, it's going to be a fair amount of money. You're right. It's an actual increase. The cost, the 17th game, is another thing I think people don't really have total clarity on. We know football is a horribly brutal sport. We know adding another game increases not only, you know, the wear and tear one would normally incur, but also the likelihood of devastating injuries. So it's not something you can easily quantify, Dominique.
Yeah, it's tough. And it's, I don't know that there's any effective research out there. I know that both the union leadership and the league believe, I would assume that they believe that it is not going to, I know that they believe that it's not going to have detrimental impacts, but who knows? Like, you know, it's hard to test that until you test it. And I do think that adding another game, and no matter how much practice you take away, it's not going to be equivalent to the intensity of collisions and stress on your joints as you would have for one game. So I think they want to argue that it is physically neutral, but I think it's impossible. You have to be honest with yourself, particularly older veteran players who aren't playing in that fourth preseason game, who aren't practicing incredibly hard throughout the season. There's nothing you can do to make up for adding another game as far as like the risk is concerned. So that's why I think that is a cost. And no matter what they say, I know that's the sticking point for the veteran players who are also, as is noted in these leaked documents, they are not going to get, many of them aren't going to get their full 1/17th, or excuse me, their full 16-week salary increase, whereas a lot of players will add another game and they'll get just as much as they made for the other games. The veteran players who make over about $4 million, I think it is, when they play in that 17th game, the top that they can get is $250,000, which is not equivalent to somebody like Aaron Rodgers, who makes like $2 million a game.
And as you know, labor negotiations, and you, it's all about precedent, right? I mean, like, once you do this, this is the biggest card the players have, is this additional game. And once you play that, it's over. Like, this, you played it, you got what you got for it. And then it's up to 18th game for the next time. But this is like their biggest point of leverage that they have. And it's been that way for a while. Let me ask you this, Dominique. I think sometimes when we talk about cost benefit, 17th game, who wins, money, we always think about it through the lens of like a JJ Watt. Do you think there's a disparity in how, let's say, like I said, over half of the players in the NFL are playing on minimum salaries, right? So How do different players in different positions in their career, you talked a little bit about some of the veterans who make X amount of money, like, do you think that they will all look at this differently?
Yes and no, because there's this situation in American society, at least writ large, is that we kind of all think we're going to be millionaires at some point. And I think the same thing exists amongst players, is no one acknowledges that they're going to be one of those guys that washes out of the league after 2 years or after 3 years. They all think that they're going to get their chance and they're going to eventually be the star guy. But I think by and large, if you're honest about the assessment, like a clear-minded person from the outside would recognize that adding an extra game now, assuming that those guys don't like have some sort of catastrophic injury in that 17th mm-hmm. game, adding that extra game and the money that comes with it will mean that you'll make more money over the course of your career if you're one of those guys who's going to have a 2, 3, maybe 4 year career. Well, if you're a guy who's already into your second deal, that extra game is not going to have any noticeable impact on the amount of money that you make unless you make it to free agency again, in which case you can negotiate and the idea of having a bigger salary cap, you might be able to extract bigger value. But that's one of the biggest problems. If I'm going to criticize this deal, one of the biggest problems I'm having is this deal is there is no constraint on quarterback salaries necessarily, because I could imagine a situation where the 17th game obviously increases the violence and wear and tear for almost every position except for quarterback. I mean, I guess it does to some degree, but not in the same level as it would for a lineman, linebacker, running back, safety, sure, blah, blah, blah. But then when you get to free agency, who has the leverage to extract the biggest amount of that increase? It's going to go to the quarterbacks. So I find that interesting that they didn't negotiate or no one fought for some sort of quarterback exemption or NFL, NBA style max salary, something that would ensure that the money that is added to this pot goes to the guys who will be at higher risk.
Yeah, kickers and punters are like, hell yeah, 17 exactly. games? Let's play 45 games.
Exactly.
I'm all
right.
in.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I mean, and I think, again, this is like something I think people forget when we try to talk about unions and deals, like, and try to evaluate them on behalf of the players. You're not talking about all the players. Everybody, especially in a league like the NFL where everybody's careers are so different, like the amount of money made, your window, the amount of, as you point out, physical harm you incur. It's so different player to player, which is, I mean, historically why it's so challenging to negotiate right. like a deal where everybody wins. There is no deal, even the last deal where everybody said, well, you know, veterans are getting screwed or the right. rookies are getting screwed. Yeah, but somebody won, right?
Yeah.
Like, in all of these deals, there are winners and losers amongst the players. I mean,
and that's stuff
you could
that
argue
you laid out.
The revenue share is the thing right. that benefits everyone.
Yep.
You want to grow the revenue share. But after that, it's a mix.
And the stuff that you laid out is also the reason why it's hard, not only the reason why it's hard to evaluate the deal, it's the reason why it's hard to have any level of leverage in a traditional sense. Because unions, like their leverage is, we're gonna go on strike. And if you're like, go back to the olden days, it made sense for everyone, like pre-93, yes, let's go on strike because free agency is that valuable. Let's go on strike because a pension is that valuable to all of us. At the point that we're at now, these incremental changes are not that valuable to any one player, even if you're an older player. So let's say that you're Drew Brees or Tom Brady. Giving up a year in your 40s, like, that might be the last time you play football. I imagine that those guys are looking at this like, I don't care what the deal is. Let's have a season.
Yeah.
If you're a young guy who recognizes that the pool of players, if you miss a whole season, the pool of players that you would have to compete with to get a roster spot is just the guys that are coming out as rookies like you. You miss a whole season, there's a whole new crop of rookies coming out, and it gets even more difficult for you to get into the league. And then you talk about guys who are already have contracts signed, and you're like, all right, I'm slated to make $12 million next year. I don't care about some work stoppage so that we can get another extra percentage. That's not going to add anything to my yeah. contract. I want to play. If we miss those games, that's money that I'll never get back. So that's one of the reasons why it's tough, why it might have been easier back in the day. And you think about labor unions outside of sports, like, all right, we're going to go on strike for healthcare. It's that important that we all get healthcare. It's not the same situation for a modern sports union.
Yeah, and given how wealthy owners are. I mean, well, I guess, yeah, you're like, well, they can sit it out. But I, again, I do think the timing of the TV deals does throw a slight wrench into that. It does help the players to some extent, right? Because it, it does.
Yeah, I agree.
So. I mean,
I agree, but it's about a level of pain, I guess. And I think it's inarguable that the amount of pain that an NFL owner would feel from missing a season is less than
always going to be the case.
Yeah, than most of the players.
Let's wrap here. Let's talk about this from a football perspective. You and I have talked a little bit about an expanded playoff and whether or not that's going to like dilute the quality. I don't think it's a huge problem. As I pointed out to you, I kind of went back and looked at the teams that would have made it in. They're usually better than a lot of the teams that make it in, like the bad division winners. But it's a lot of football. I saw this morning Warren Sharp pointed out, like, if you're doing a Sunday night wild card and a Monday night wild card, for example, you're forcing teams to play with shorter rest, potentially, as they go into the divisional round. It's definitely approaching saturation.
Right.
Does that concern you?
No. I mean, my issue, my opinion about adding anything, changing the game, is like it should be about making it better, not just necessarily selling more of it. And this, I do think that you could argue that adding this extra playoff spot makes it better. I don't think there's any way to argue that adding a 17th playoff, or excuse me, a 17th regular season game makes it better. But I do think that you could argue that adding this extra playoff does, because of the point that you made and research that you did about the efficiency of the teams that get left out. So there's always at least one game every year that we're kind of like, I don't know, in the wild card round where we're like, I don't really
want to see that.
Yeah, this year.
Tighten up.
You can't say that's the case, but I guess having two of those games, people still watch it and still love it, so that doesn't make it any worse. Yeah.
100%. People are still going to watch this.
And I think it adds the suspense of having that opportunity to have another late game situation, where that's kind of what decides our football weekend. Is like, if we can look back at one game and say, hey, that game had a moment in it, you add one more game, you're more likely to get that. You won't have a dead round. So I don't have any problem with the extra playoff game as much as I do with the 17th regular season game.
The 17th game I think is bad for football because it just increases the likelihood of a star getting hurt before the playoffs, right? I mean,
That's a good point. No, what happened to all that stuff that we were talking about? Remember they floated out there like we might have guys that could only be active for a certain amount of games.
Oh, right. Like the quarterback can only... and everybody was like, that's really stupid. Nobody wants to watch the backup quarterback play. I can't remember. It was before the season. Yeah.
But that I feel like really that would be wise to do, or at least interesting to do for non-quarterbacks. Like, because as we talked about, the quarterbacks are going to be extremely protected. There might be plenty of injuries to them, but I'm not sure how much more difficult it would be. But since, like, I can be honest about this and I can say this, no one really cares. Like, the general public is more likely to tune in if there's a big quarterback matchup than if both of the starting corners are healthy or out there. Like, I imagine that you could offset some of the risk of playing for pretty much the rest of the guys throughout the course of the season without seeing a noticeable impact on the quality of play. But I guess then it's the gamesmanship of when do you sit down, which players, and when.
Right. That would get, that gets interesting.
For football nerds like you and me.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was, you know, I was hoping to see more roster expansion, quite frankly, along with this deal. But I mean, I think what's best for football is to have all of the stars playing as deep into the playoffs as possible. There's no doubt about that. But you're not wrong that the quarterback, I mean, as long as you've got your quarterback, you can still argue that it'll be a good game. It's when you, like, when you have two or three teams without their starting quarterbacks that you get into some real bad football territory in the postseason.
That'd be rough. I don't think
it's been rough in the past.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. And
we would have gotten Mahomes Rudolph, or Hodges rather, Mahomes Hodges round one if we had the 14th seed this year.
Well, it'd have been interesting to see how the Chiefs would have fell behind in that game. that'd be tough for them to pull off.
Steelers have a good defense, too, in their defense. A great defense, I think. All right, let's take some questions.
Question. Lenny, for your thoughts.
As always, thank you for your excellent iTunes reviews. I get the best iTunes reviews of any podcast. I really do. Convertometric asks, what is your favorite post-sack celebration? I wonder, like all time?
BJ Raji.
Oh, yeah.
Google it.
What would you do if you, were a defensive end?
Yeah, I don't know. Do I have any career sacks? I don't think I have any career sacks. I got some hits, but I don't have any career sacks, I don't think.
He's saying sacks, folks.
Oh.
How do you feel about the thing the teams do now where we all go into the end zone? You love it. You're on.
I love it.
Okay. So at first I'm obviously pro celebration, pro all of that, but it's kind of like after the 20th time, you're like, again, like mix it up a little.
Yeah, I guess it gets a little tiresome, but
a little creativity.
The sprint to the end zone is so fun. When they start running, and other guys join on, and they're like a flock of geese running back, and there are guys running off the sideline who weren't even on the field for the play, and then you pose at the end like that. That is fun anticipation. But I mean, I do like some originality. I don't know. I feel like the sexually suggestive dances are always beneficial. A good Von Miller pelvic thrust is great.
Michael Bennett used to do the extremely graphic pumps, and then I think the NFL told him to stop, and then he started to do like the half, like the Key and Peele kind of thing.
That is
okay.
Fun.
This is actually a really difficult question. I was thinking about this before we started taping, but I want to hear your answer first. JW is right. 12 asks, next season, who is the best division in the AFC, or which rather? Not easy. Not easy. So I think you can rule out.
Yeah, I mean, we're done with the East. They're not good. The North could be good if the Browns get better. Because, I mean, the East is like...
Will the Steelers get Ben back?
Yeah, the East is the Patriots division, right? For those who don't know. And I'd rule out that because no team in there is all that good, and I don't think the Patriots are going to be that good.
I agree. I'd throw out the AFC East.
Yeah,
the North
is the Steelers D. If Ben comes back and the Browns turn out to be good, the Bengals are going to be trash. So, but the Ravens, I suspect, will be pretty good. You got that. So right now, I'm going to lean towards the North. Who am I missing?
The West, you've got the Chiefs and the Chargers, but the Chargers are very much in flux.
Yeah, so you got the Chiefs.
And then
you got the Colts,
another one,
and the Titans.
Big time in Colts, Titans, Texans, all in flux. Well, not the Texans, but like.
Yeah. I think that's tough depending on what happens with the Texans defense. And I think the Titans will be good. I'm not sure. Tannehill cannot. There's a ceiling, and he played above it for much of the end of that season. I don't think that Tannehill is going to be able to replicate that throughout the course of next year. But I do think the Titans will be good.
The Chargers had a good quarterback.
Yeah, but they don't.
Well, there's a lot of teams that don't right now. But
right, I know.
What if Rivers goes to the Colts?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could look at the protection numbers and say Rivers and Wash, they just couldn't protect him in Los Angeles. But I don't feel like Rivers is.
Well, that's a good transition to the next question.
You didn't answer the question. I picked the North. You picked somebody else. You got the West. All right, moving on. Mark this down. We'll check it at the end of next year.
I got the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl, so.
I picked them to win the Super Bowl before last season.
Craney DSM asks, should the Chargers take a top-tier offensive lineman instead of a quarterback? So obviously this is, Field Yates and I talked about this last week, kind of like what all the teams should do with the quarterbacks, and it's complicated with the Chargers because they could, I want them to trade for Cam. That's my desire, but like if you're the Chargers, would you rather trade up for Tua or get an offensive lineman and sign someone or trade? Because you've got a win now roster.
Yeah. So then I guess that suggests you trade up. Well, no, not for Tua, because Tua said himself that he would love a situation where he could sit out. But I guess maybe that means you win next year.
He'll play in 6 weeks.
That's true.
NFL. They got Tyrod.
The tough thing about that question is I like when that question is quarterback versus pass rusher because I feel like you can reliably predict how a defensive end is going to perform. I feel like quarterback.
Bill Barnwell disagrees.
Really?
He did a whole thing on this. Yeah.
Well, then I'm wrong.
About how
Bill's
there's
always
been a lot
right.
of. I know. It feels like Chase Young's a can't miss. So
yeah,
like,
well, know, I guess is,
people are talking.
I'm arguing at the high spot.
Yeah.
Well, I have to see what Bill wrote, but I do think that I feel less confident in offensive linemen than I do defensive linemen.
Oh, 100%.
So that's
point. Fair.
So my point stands is that it seems like the choice is between high risk and low risk. And if you're going with the offensive lineman, it's high risk and high risk. Why not go for the quarterback in which the reward is so much higher? So I would say go quarterback if you can, as a matter of speaking, like generally speaking. And I don't think that, I think it does apply also to the Charger situation.
All right. Goffs asks, which team is most likely to trade up in the draft? Ooh. Let's focus on Tua.
Okay.
So right now, I'm going to read the draft. Well, yes. Okay. So right now, here's the draft order, because I feel like the question is, like, which of these teams are actually going to move above Miami at 5 and go for it? So right behind, so you've got the Lions, the Giants, the Dolphins. Then you've got the Chargers, the Panthers, not the Cardinals, the Jaguars, the Colts. You have the Raiders at 12, but I don't think they're going to. Well, they could. So yeah. Those are all teams that could, and then the Bucks at 14. Those are all teams that could hypothetically trade up. The problem is the Dolphins have 3 first round picks.
Exactly. So, I don't know the draft capital of the rest of those teams, but I said the Dolphins because they need a quarterback. They don't need to win next season. And I also know that they have gone through the painstaking effort of dumping a bunch of talented players in order to build up the draft capital. I know that they have enough to move up. So that's my thought, is that their fear is someone's going to try to move above them. Because the 3 teams in front of them aren't going to get quarterbacks, so they might be forced to outbid if the Chargers or the Panthers or one of those teams call up Washington or Detroit. It would be wise of Washington or Detroit to then call the Dolphins and say, "Hey, Tua may not be there."
If you're the Panthers, would you trade? Like, so you don't have the assets. Would you trade like Christian McCaffrey? People hate this question.
No. No, hell no. I would not trade Christian McCaffrey. If I'm the Panthers, I sign my coach to a really long deal, and I would go serious rebuild.
Rebuild,
and not try to
But that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but I don't think you do it in a way where you are not giving away the best player on your team, you know, who is also pretty young. And I guess maybe you would argue at running back, he'll no longer be around when the rebuild is ready. Yeah, I don't know.
It's not a crazy idea.
If the rebuild, I don't mean not around, but like he's a running back. So if the rebuild, say they're in Super Bowl contention 3 years from now, what is Christian McCaffrey at that point? I don't know. He won't be what he is now at that position.
Jay Snipe asks, I love these like straw man question. Why is Drew Brees praised for only winning 1 Super Bowl? Why Aaron Rodgers is criticized for it? I will say, it does feel like Drew Brees gets less criticism for that than Rodgers. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I would argue that it's probably because Drew Brees' Super Bowl has more value because it came on the, I mean, in the minds of everyone else, because it came on the heels of Hurricane Katrina. You combine with the fact that he tore up his shoulder and was kind of left for dead by San Diego, and the career that he's had, I think a lot of people view it as like gravy, and he's like a shorter guy, and so we're like, hey, he saved New Orleans with the Super Bowl after Katrina, and he's a little guy who overcame injury, so people look at that differently than they do the Aaron Rodgers situation. It's my best guess.
Those are good examples to actually segue us to the conversation I want to have about paying quarterbacks a lot of money, a big percentage of your cap, and whether or not you can still win a Super Bowl, because both of those players came very, very close to going to the Super Bowl. Brees, you know, quite recently, before the infamous pass interference that wasn't, and then Rodgers in that one NFC championship with Seattle, both made significant, pretty sizable percentages of their cap. And because they didn't, we've maintained this idea that since the last CBA, you have to have a rookie quarterback to make it to the Super Bowl. Quarterback on a rookie deal, pardon me. I always say rookie quarterback and I mean that. Yeah, right. So, it's only been 5 times that a Super Bowl winner has had a quarterback whose salary has made up more than 10% of the cap. So people point to that. I think this is interesting, Dominique. It gets brought up a lot, and I don't agree with it, and it bothers me. And we're looking at this question of whether you pay, should you pay Dak Prescott a ton of money and make, you know, help make it. And I want to talk to you about that, and I want to talk to you about the Cowboys, but first I want to talk to you about this idea and whether or not you agree with it.
I don't agree with it, and I'm excited now because when you said this was one of the topics, I got a little nervous because I was going to be like, am I wrong? And is Mina going to bring out all these numbers and proof why I'm wrong? Because I do believe that it does not kill your team. Obviously, quarterbacks are overvalued, you could argue, by what they actually contribute to a team. However, the scarcity makes them, like, extremely valuable. So I don't think there's any question. You know how I feel about Rain, Dakota Prescott. The Cowboys should pay him. They should have paid him a long time ago, and I don't think that this cripples their team. I think choosing not to pay him puts them in a real bad spot.
So my feeling has always been you can pay your quarterback as long as it's the right quarterback, right? You get into the impossible situation when you've got a bad quarterback on a a lucrative deal. And there are all these, like, examples where, like, a quarterback who was on a veteran deal should have won the Super Bowl. Like, I just mentioned Rodgers and Brees. Matt Ryan, 28-3, was on a deal. And there's this great piece by Bob Sturm, who writes about the Cowboys for The Athletic, and you should read his stuff if you don't, where he looked at not just the Super Bowls, but the teams that made it to the championships over the last 10 years, since the last CBA. And he found that 13 were on rookie deals, 11 were on top 10 deals, and 12 were veterans on, quote-unquote, inexpensive deals, but 6 of those 12 were Tom Brady. So he's totally, I think, skewed our perception of this issue, even though, as I recently said, I don't think his deals have been as cheap as sometimes it's been characterized. So it really is like a sample size kind of issue to me. Like, sure, it makes your life as a GM easier. It increases your margin of error for signings. But I think it's like the notion that you should pass on a good quarterback on a veteran deal.
Nonsense.
I think it is nonsense. And really, we're talking about like differences of like a lot of times with these deals, like this question of Dak Prescott. Well, he rejected a deal that was $33 million because he wanted $44 million. Okay, we're talking about $7 million a year. I know it adds up, but like you want to start over because of $7 million? You want to roll the dice? You know what I mean? And like go with like a Minshew or something? I don't know. It bothers me that people are so hardline about it.
Yeah, I mean, this ties into the CBA discussion because a lot of people have mentioned to me, like, why don't they go after taking away the franchise tag? But this is why you don't. And this speaks to your point of interconnectivity of how all these things, there's a winner and a loser on both the owner sides and the player sides. And like all the owners aren't the same. There's differences there. But imagine what happens if you take away the franchise tag. Then Dak Prescott comes up on the end of his deal and he has all the leverage. And he's like, you know what? Give me $60 million. The Cowboys will have to pay it, or he'll go into the market and someone will pay him 65 or 70. And we all celebrate. That's a big deal, but it's a hard cap sport. So you know where that money then comes from. So while players in general all hate the franchise tag, it only affects a few players each year, and the actual impact of it is reducing the negotiating power of those particular players, which then leaves more money. And if there is a minimum spend, which there is, that money has to go to somebody else.
You know, thinking like the franchise tag is an incredibly important issue and all this is a lot like, I don't know, it's kind of like a overemphasis on meritocracy and kind of winner take all culture, right? I mean, that's like you prioritizing, okay, well, if he's the best player, he deserves to be paid, you know, what he actually is worth in the market, which sure, but that's like a certain ideological viewpoint. And when people talk about that, they don't acknowledge what you've described, which is there, you know, the franchise tag is basically like socialism.
I love this podcast. I mean, in the NFL, like it's like, so it's very socialism. Like,
totally.
You look, it's
no one gets
it's,
paid what they're worth.
Yeah,
no one.
It's ruthlessly
Kirk Cousins,
capital.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, and like the idea of the draft is like socialism. It's not like you get rewarded. Like it's all of it. And revenue sharing between teams is all like socialism. But the NFL is like ruthlessly capitalistic in some points. And then other times like, hey, let's spread the wealth.
By the tag thing is very pertinent to the Cowboys, right? Because as I understand it, if there's a new deal, they can only, teams can only use one. The franchise or the
transition.
Or transition. Right. You can't do both. And the Cowboys have a lot of mouths to feed. So in addition to Dakota Rain, you've got Amari Cooper. And I think there's a lot of questions. Okay, maybe they'll tag both of them and we can talk about that. And then you've got Byron Jones, who was their former first round safety, now cornerback. You've got Robert Quinn, who was like weirdly awesome last year and is the guy I always talk about who's younger than you think. He is not 30. It's so weird. How is he on? Look it up. Oh, wait. No, maybe he just turned 30. Hold on.
Either way.
No, he's 29. He's 29.
What?
I know. It's really upsetting every time I find it out. Okay. It's not upsetting. It's good for him. I'm glad for him. He should get another contract. But yes, he feels, he seems like he should be 45 years old right now.
It's Rain Dakota, by the way. Just, I mean, since we're, since we're teaching people stuff.
Rain Dakota. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, his first name is Rain.
And then there's Randall Cobb. There's a bunch of other guys. But, you know, it's really
Byron Jones. Dak Amari, Byron Jones, right?
So, yeah. So, Dak Amari and Byron are like the big three. And I think there's a lot of questions about whether or not you can pay all of them. You can, because the, you can. But, and this is the other thing I wanted to get your take on, then you are leaning very hard into stars and scrubs, right? Which is a style of team building. So right now, the Cowboys have over $70 million in cap space, which is interesting. And then because they do these like 5 to 6 year deals, I think Tyron Smith is on a 45 year deal. You can, the Cowboys always do this and then they can move money around and restructure them, right? So they can pay all three of them. It's a little harder, I think, if they tag both Prescott and Amari, but they can definitely tag one of them, whatever. The problem is then you have no other money to work with. And then you've got a, you know, $40 million quarterback, a $22 million wide receiver, and a $15 million cornerback on your roster, which there are very few teams in the NFL that are constituted that way.
Yeah, it's difficult because you, it makes you stars and scrubs, as you mentioned. And it's not just like you are top heavy as far as like your starting lineup is good. The backups are bad. You probably end up with some guys starting who may be backups elsewhere because you can't necessarily afford to, to pay that level. And what it requires then is we always talk about how, and we've all accepted to some degree until you brought this up about how you have to pay or you have to have your rookie quarterback or your quarterback on a rookie deal to succeed so that you can pay your other guys. Like it changes that calculus some if you overpay or not overpay. If you are paying for a bunch of stars is then you need to find guys on rookie deals at other positions. Like if you could get starting level caliber play at other positions, then you can get away with this stars scrubs, so to speak, philosophy. You can't actually get away with it if all you have is stars and scrubs. You need stars and like overachievers.
You have to draft well, basically. Right. I mean, and this is what always drives me crazy with Seattle when everyone's like, well, they went downhill once they paid Russell Wilson. Look at their drafts, people. Look at the first draft picks of the last 5 years and then get back to me. Again, it makes your life harder when you pay a quarterback a lot of money, but it's not their fault that you've made bad choices. You know, and the Cowboys, by the way, Dominique, again, it's not just, they actually have drafted pretty well, but they also handed out a bunch of contracts last year. Jalen Smith, Ezekiel Elliott, those sort of like 10 to, we're not going to do the running backs thing now, but I'm just saying they paid guys last year, right? And if you're now that you've got the benefit of hindsight, Jalen Smith has a wonderful story, but would you rather have paid him, what is it, like $10 or $12 million a year, or have money to pay Byron Jones now?
Yeah, I mean,
Sean Lee's a free agent too.
Yeah, the decisions that they made last year were all predicated on winning the Super Bowl this year. You know, like if they win the Super Bowl this year, then the Ezekiel Elliott contract, the Jalen Smith contract, like all that were like, well, it was worth it because they put it all in and won the Super Bowl. But now when you're trying to expand your window, now it's kind of like, that sucks. But I do hate the way this is setting up because of some of these bad decisions. When they pay Dak, if they fall off a cliff,
everyone's going to blame him.
See, Dak's not good enough. Like, no, you're just not smart enough.
Five more questions for you. One from Lenny.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks
I'm getting paid for this, right?
Question one, are you watching The Outsider?
No.
Oh, I tried to get you to watch it. So funny.
I'm sorry. I'll start tonight.
Okay, what are you watching?
My kids.
Peppa Pig. Daniel the Tiger.
I mean, my kids are a little older now. I have a 4-year-old, but she's all about PJ Masks. The older kids, you don't know anything about kids TV.
Those are the three shows I know.
I did see Sonic back to back Saturdays. So if you are living life, now you know what you can look forward to.
Back,
I saw
stars?
With my son last weekend, and then my daughter was like, but I wanted to see Sonic. So
oh, no.
I went with my daughter this weekend. Back-to-back Sonic. So they made some improvements on the graphics, and I thought that Sonic was exactly what you expected. So what's that? That's like 3 out of 5 stars. Like, I wasn't disappointed in Sonic. However, I wasn't like, oh, that's some Pixar-level animated picture action. Nah, it was all right.
I watched the DC Defenders and the St. Louis Battlehawks. So I'm not really in a place to judge you. All right. Question number two. Do grapes taste better on airplanes?
No.
I agree. I've seen this take on the internet. I think they taste worse on airplanes.
Yeah. Nah, I didn't.
Fruit is always weird on airplanes.
It's funny that we go from a movie take to a plane take, because I do think that movies are better on airplanes. There are many movies that I've watched on airplanes that I'm like, hey, that's a good movie.
Like,
and
what?
I see it again later and I'm like, eh. I did watch, you remember the Denzel movie Flight?
I would never watch that on
exactly.
an airplane.
I mean, I'm a risk taker, baby. I'll live life on the edge. It made it more interesting. I was
no
on the plane.
Way.
I was on the plane watching planes crash and was like, oh, this is a bad choice, but hey, we're living.
You're a crazy person. question number three. What is your favorite scenario for Tua? Because this is the X factor in the draft. It's going to be chaos. Everyone's going to be trying to trade up. What is like the chaos scenario you like the most? Not what you think will happen.
Yeah, I think having like the anarchy of having like a fuse that's being lit at both ends of the Bengals drafting or the Bengals making their selection of Joe Burrow, and then someone makes a trade to jump in front of the Dolphins. And then Washington makes a pick, and then the Dolphins try to make a pick to jump in front of, I think it'll be the Lions. Just watching that, those two trains coming at each other at the same time, like that's what I would like, is multiple trades in the first 5 picks of teams just selling the farm to jump in front of each other to get to injured Tua.
The Patriots signed Tom Brady to a 2-year deal and then trade him for Tua. What's happened?
My heart almost dropped because I thought you were breaking news to me right now.
Trade him to Miami. That'd be so amazing. All right. Question number four. So you weren't, like I said, we did this QB carousel last week and talked about all the free agents and such. And like who we think should sign where, yada, 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 yada. What would you like the Bears to do?
I want to double down on Trubisky, sign him to a 6-year extension, make him the highest paid quarterback in the league. That's all he needs.
Go
by the Tom Coughlin philosophy.
Confidence.
We got to get the guys in the locker room to follow him by paying him more than he's worth. That's what Tom Coughlin said about paying Nick Foles, right?
Yeah, you just gotta get the faith going.
I don't know. I mean, I think everyone going for, I think the obvious one is Cam Newton, because we assume that our Andy Reid disciple and Matt Nagy could use an athletic quarterback, and Cam Newton is essentially what Mitch Trubisky wishes he could be, I guess, as far as using his athleticism and arm, like peak Cam Newton. Not that we've seen it often, but I do think that that would be an interesting fit there.
Last question, as always, comes from Lenny. Lenny saw a clip of you on Highly Questionable where Bomani pointed out that if you flipped your head upside down, it looked like Dan Levitard's head, which everybody took to make fun of Dan for having big cheeks. But Lenny said, well, isn't that pointing out Dominique has a giant forehead? It's more of a statement than a question.
Yeah, that's your personal favorite take. I'm surprised that Lenny had taken it.
Lenny just literally
my forehead.
Lenny
the reason why no one was actually saying that is because comparing foreheads, like my forehead's not as big as Bomani's. Like, come on. If someone's forehead's going to be exposed there, and it ain't me. My hairline is still going strong-ish.